I next met with Dr. Philip Philip, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice with hepatocellular cancer.
A 74-year-old gentleman who has known history of alcohol abuse, but also is known to have hepatitis C. And he was having some abdominal symptoms last year, and he had a CAT scan, and it showed a suspicious area in the liver. And then later in the year, he did have further investigation, and now he has three areas in the liver. And the measurements were 4.2 centimeter, 3.2 centimeter, and one was 1.9 centimeters. So these were hypervascular lesions. He underwent a biopsy. And then again, the biopsy in this situation could be argued with or against. He had a biopsy which showed a well-differentiated hepatocellular cancer. So he came to see us. His Child's Pugh A status was 7, so he was a Child's Pugh B 7. His liver function tests were otherwise okay. His albumin was 3.5. Bilirubin was 2.1. That's what tipped the Child's Pugh system into more of B. He did not have ascites or encephalopathy. So the question is, how do you manage this patient? He does have a number of other comorbidities. So he has hypertension. I think he also has diabetes. And we had a discussion of this patient in our tumor board. So in our tumor board, we go over the patients where it's not clear-cut which modality to go first with, but we also do it in any patient we see. And this patient, the options that were presented to him in another facility, a sister facility to us, were you have four options, but two of them are really not possible. So he was told that a transplant is not an option for him, and we agreed with that because as a starter, his disease in terms of three lesions and all of them, which should be less than three, but two of them were already over 3 centimeters, so he did not qualify for that. The second option that he was talked about was resection, and again, that was ruled out because of his partly Child Pugh status, but mostly because of his comorbidities. It wasn't felt that he can tolerate major resections. He had three lesions. In a younger patient, you might go for it, but not this patient at this time. The other option was liver-directed therapy, and the other option, obviously, was sorafenib. So these were the options which were discussed with him, and he came to us as a tertiary referral center for us to take over his management.
So what was the discussion that went on in your tumor board? I'm assuming there was an interventional radiologist and surgeon there?
Correct. So interventional radiologist, surgeon, but we also have radiation oncologists because we do a lot of SBRT, stereotactic body radiation treatment. The discussion with him went along the lines of, let's start with liver-directed therapy using radioembolization. And the issue of ablation down the line was also a possibility. A good evidence-based solution was, well, we do the radioembolization. Shall we add the sorafenib now or wait until he has disease progression? And that's an area which we still are somewhat challenged in terms of the evidence to go either way. Some people go with it, and even if you do sorafenib, you start it before, during, or after. But at this particular patient, my own plan will be to treat him with the radioembolization, so I put the request to have that done. And we will watch the patient after that and see what happens. The interesting thing about the radioembolization, from my own experience, is that the response rate to radioembolization can extend to months and sometimes many months. And it becomes difficult sometimes when you add another treatment after that, whether that treatment is doing anything or not. And it's a true thing. I can see responses months and months and months after I've done the radioembolization. That's something you have to keep in mind.
Are there any situations that you can describe in a patient who has liver-only HCC where you do use sorafenib?
Well, there are. I see those patients also. Part of my practice is in downtown Detroit, so I see, unfortunately, a fair number of patients who do have disease where a liver-directed therapy will not be a good option, mostly because of safety issues, because the Child Pugh status might not be helpful. A patient is at risk of developing liver dysfunction and even going to renal failure if we're not comfortable with that. There are patients who have more extensive disease, and those are the ones which I'm also referring to, because sometimes those patients will not be good candidates for liver-directed therapy. Patients whose performance status is borderline. You have to go back to the literature and see that there are two studies, randomized trials in the literature on transarterial chemoembolization, and those studies were positive, but if you look at the patient characteristics, they were good patients. They were Child's Pugh A patients. They were good performance status patients. So at some point, we have to draw a line on how really can you justify doing liver-directed therapy in patients who are performance status 2 or 3, or they have more extensive disease, or they have Child's Pugh B or even C. I wouldn't recommend maybe for C, but certainly in B. And And there are patients who, therefore, will not be candidates for liver directed therapy. Those patients, my next step is to give them sorafenib. But the challenge here is that the patient who will not qualify for a liver directed therapy will be also a patient who may not be represented, or was not represented, or was not represented in the study that was done with the sorafenib, the SHARP trial, because the SHARP trial included patients with Child's PUA. There were patients with favorable performance status. So the question is, how do you really manage the sorafenib in those patients who are selected out of liver-directed therapy? Now you want to give them sorafenib. And the question is, do you start those patients with a full dose of the sorafenib, or you start with lower dose? And what is the level of concern about sorafenib causing problems in those borderline patients?
What do you do?
Depending on the patient, again, it's a personalized decision. In patients who have Child's PUB, and I rarely treat the patients with Child's PUC with sorafenib, I tend to start with, especially the older patients, start with lower doses. And the key thing about those patients is that you have to really see them frequently to start off with. Because I've seen patients who you can discover the non-tolerance very early on, within a week or two of starting the treatment. So when I start a patient, especially an older patient who has Child's PUB and the performance status is borderline, I will see them every week. And I will start with a dose which will be either 400, at most I go 600. And I've had patients who I started also on 200, depending on the patient.
I've heard people talk about sort of having a slightly different approach within Child PUB based on whether it's a 7 or an 8 or 9. Is that what you do?
I think that's what, in a way, I'm referring to. If I'm Child's PUB 7, then I might be closer to the maybe 600 or 800, and the other ones I go, that's exactly right, yes. That's why I mentioned it's a personalized decision.
What about beyond sorafenib? There are a bunch of agents that are being looked at right now, but in terms of outside of a trial setting, what do you think about once you go beyond sorafenib?
Well, at this point in time, I really do not have a drug that I can recommend to patients in terms of outside of a clinical trial. I have to tell you that I see sometimes people use capecitabine in this situation, but there is no real evidence for that. At this point in time, patients who fail sorafenib, unless they can go in a clinical trial, there is really no other treatment that one can say has evidence to back that approach.
There is a press release out there from the so-called STORM trial, an adjuvant study of sorafenib in HCC, saying that it didn't meet its primary endpoint of recurrence-free survival. Does this surprise you?
I didn't expect it to be negative. I was thinking more it's going to be positive, but I didn't expect it to really have a good going hazard ratio either. So I'm not surprised in some ways, but I was hoping and expecting it to be positive. It could be that the duration of the treatment is something which matters in this situation. We don't know. And also, we don't know what happened to the patients when they had a recurrence, because we don't know if there were confounding treatment factors that might have affected the study in terms of the imbalances that can happen between arms. Remember, the treatment of this disease is not as uniform as we'd like it to be, especially at the global level. People can approach disease management in different ways. And again, I don't know how well we control the treatments beyond sorafenib or the placebo in this situation.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, you know, the data from this trial. I'm even interested to see how they actually carried it out. I mean, I don't think there are that many patients who are in the adjuvant situation, are there?
No, at least not in this country. There might be in other places where the disease might have a bit of a different natural history, but no, we don't have that many patients who go into this trial. There are a number of variables. It's not an easy thing to do in a disease like this because the variables are too many. Keeping in mind the natural history of the disease can change also, can be different with the etiology. So it will be very interesting to see how the patients were balanced out on this study.
That will be interesting. Where do you see things heading with HCC? There are a number of trials looking at new agents. One I was curious about, because we saw some results in gastric cancer that were sort of encouraging, the ramucirumab, the anti-VEGFR antibody that in gastric cancer has activity alone and with chemotherapy taxane. I think in HCC there's a study looking at ramucirumab without chemo. Any thoughts about where that might be heading?
So that would be an interesting study. And again, the interesting things are that this is a disease where hypervascularity on a CAT scan or MRI we think translates to overactivation of the VEGF-VEGFR pathway, so that's our simplistic way of looking at it. But in fact, we do use liver-directed therapy because, again, we believe the vascularity side of things in the management of this disease. So ramucirumab is an interesting drug. Before that, bevacizumab, which was tested, and in a pilot trial, there was benefit from bevacizumab study done several years ago. However, when we came to larger trials using bevacizumab, again in the randomized phase 2 setting and pilot phase 2 setting, we didn't really see that much of an activity for bevacizumab. Ramucirumab might be a different drug because it affects the receptor rather than the growth factor, so that might be a better drug. So I think there is potential for ramucirumab. But the whole thing about using sorafenib first, and then there were a number of other drugs that were tested, some of them also the VEGFR kinase inhibitors, and which really didn't pan out. For example, brivenib. We don't know the sorafenib activity. Is it due to the VEGFR2, VEGFR receptor inhibition, or is it something else? Because a drug like sorafenib has other kinase activities. So yes, VEGFR pathway is interesting. We don't know if that's really going to be the major breakthrough in this disease. Probably not. We still need other drugs. And the c-MET inhibitors, for example, which you mentioned drugs in gastric cancer, but the other thing about gastric cancer, which is the c-MET inhibitors, have shown some interest. And that will be another area of interest in HCC in the future to see if that's an area which, or you can combine a c-MET inhibitor maybe with other drugs. So that's a possibility.
What about regorafenib? Obviously, that's been approved now in colorectal cancer, but I believe it's also being looked at in HCC. Any thoughts about that?
So regorafenib is being studied in the second-line setting in patients who fail sorafenib. The two drugs also, they have VEGFR as their one of their targets, and they have other kinases. The question is, are they so different that we can still have activity in someone who fails sorafenib? That would be a question. Again, my expectation is that it's not going to be adding much to what we have. We certainly need drugs that have different targets at this point in time than the VEGFR2 and the VEGFR.
As long as we brought up ramucirumab, maybe you can just briefly comment on where you see that heading, whether you think it's likely that this is going to be another approved drug in oncology, and if it is approved, where, if at all, you see yourself using it in gastric cancer.
So ramucirumab, which is a monoclonal antibody against VEGFR2, in a randomized trial showed benefit over best supportive care alone in patients who have failed prior chemotherapy and first-line treatment in patients with gastric cancer. So that was the initial study that was presented, and basically it raised the interest in this drug, and that was followed by the RAINBOW trial, which also was a positive trial in patients with gastric cancer beyond first-line treatment. So collectively, the data really have created a lot of interest in this drug. But as a single agent, again, it has activity. The question is the activity enough to be used as a single agent? And certainly, it's going to be used as a combination now with a taxane in this situation. That drug, in my opinion, given the strength of the evidence we have from two studies, it's likely going to be approved by the FDA. I don't see a reason why not in a situation where it's an unmet need in the second or third line treatment.
Anything unusual in terms of side effects and toxicity? And if it is coming into practice, docs should know about it. Sort of the usual VEGF stuff like hypertension?
I'm not aware of anything unusual except for the ones we expect in this class of agents that target the VEGF-VEGFR pathway.
So let's talk a little bit about pancreatic cancer, and maybe we can go through your 74-year-old lady.
This is a lady who came to me, and her performance status, I put it here, is 1 to 2, depending on who saw the patient, because she was seen again by another physician and she came to me as a tertiary referral and I had the privilege of treating her. So she presented with obstructive jaundice and she had a mass in the head of the pancreas and that was involving the SMA with less than 180 degrees, which really makes it maybe more like borderline resectable. However, a CAT scan showed that she had multiple very small lung nodules, certainly less than 1 centimeter, which we could not tell whether they were metastatic or not, and they were too small to be biopsied. At that point in time, her CA19-9 level was less than 200. So she had a bile duct stent placed, and then we had a discussion with her about chemotherapy. Normally in a situation like this where chemotherapy is my starting point, whether it's in a situation like this, where in this case we thought she probably had metastatic disease, but I'll come to that a bit later. But even with metastatic disease, we give them three options. I go with the gemcitabine versus gemcitabine plus nab-paclitaxel versus FOLFIRINOX. And I go in detail discussing the pros and cons for each regimen. And with this patient, based on my discussion, we settled with gemcitabine plus nab-paclitaxel.
I'm curious, when you think about those options, I mean, how often do people or you come to the conclusion to give gemcitabine alone, and in what kind of situation?
So in my practice, let me limit my discussion for that question to 100 patients with metastatic disease or even locally advanced unresectable disease. So those patients in my practice, 10 to 15% will go on gemcitabine alone, and then 15% will go on FOLFIRINOX, and the rest nowadays go on gem nab-paclitaxel. So it's very much along the lines of performance status as being the single most important decision maker. But also, I take into account age and also liver function tests. And one of the most important things is to take the patient's preference also, because I discuss the pros and cons with each patient for this type of treatment.
Before you go on, could I just follow up with what you just said? So I'm kind of curious, what kinds of patients in your practice of those 100 end up getting FOLFIRINOX?
So the profile would be someone who is under 75, someone whose performance status is 1 or 1.5, if you know. I don't believe there's zero performance status out there, although we always see calling zero. So it would be 1, 1.5, less than 2 or just about 2. But certainly less than 3.
When you say you don't see people with performance status 0, you mean specifically metastatic pancreatic cancer?
Correct, yes. Because there are some symptoms and limitations. There's no patient who really absolutely has nothing. And patients who don't have major liver dysfunction, I mean borderline enzyme elevation, you know, 1.5 times or even 2 times maybe, but no bilirubin elevation. I don't like FOLFIRINOX to go in a patient with liver dysfunction, which I think is going to cause problems. Those are really the patients who will go on FOLFIRINOX. I think that was your question, right?
Right. So what happened with this lady?
So after 2 cycles, which were like approximately 8 to 9 weeks, we repeated the scans, and the lung lesions were smaller. So that told us they are likely to be metastases. And her pancreatic mass got smaller, and her CA19-9 fell by more than 50%.
And how did she do in terms of the treatment, side effects, and toxicity?
The only thing was that she had fatigue grade 2, and that was her major problem. Otherwise, in terms of myelosuppression and the GI symptoms, she was fine, and no neuropathy at that point in time after 2 months. And then we repeated the scan after 4 months, and now we're seeing stability in the lung nodules, and the pancreatic mass hasn't changed much. So with this patient, given what we saw in the lungs, we felt that it's not going to be a good idea to go for a Whipple procedure in a situation like this. So we'll continue with the chemotherapy in her.
And as you continue with the chemotherapy, what do you anticipate? Where do you see things heading? Do you start pulling back on the treatment and sort of move into any kind of maintenance kind of strategy, or you just keep treating until toxicity or progression?
So basically, in going forward with this patient, based on my experience and my projection in a patient like this, there are 3 or 4 things what can happen. There is going to be more of the fatigue. Usually we see that. And we also see the cumulative effect on the myelosuppression as we continue. There are 2 things we do. One is either we reduce the dose by 20%, continue on day 1, 8, and 15, and see how that works. But I have seen also patients who cannot tolerate that. So the other option would be to go into day 1 and 15. So every other week schedule.
Any observations in terms of neurotoxicity with NAB?
In my practice, and I've been using a lot of the gem nab-paclitaxel, the neurotoxicity has not been really that much of a problem if you're going within the 6 months up to that point. I think longer patients may have it, but we're not seeing so much of the neurotoxicity. And I think it's partly because we're reducing the doses more and we're more proactive in trying to manage side effects. But neurotoxicity has not been really that difficult to manage in my population of patients I've seen.
So I want to ask you a little bit about colon cancer, but I have to ask you one other thing. Are you by any chance involved with review of abstracts in pancreatic for ASCO?
Not this year.
Because I'm curious if you've heard anything. You know, we saw this press release about ruxolitinib and capecitabine in pancreatic cancer. I don't know whether it's going to be presented at ASCO or the near future. And also, the press release referred mysteriously to some subset within the trial that seemed to benefit. Any thoughts about that, what we might see, and about this kind of strategy? It's a pretty different approach.
So basically, with the drug ruxolitinib, which targets the JAK-STAT pathway, remember the JAK-STAT pathway is also a link to the cytokines and the cytokines acting through it. And as you know, that's a great story for the hematological malignancies also. So the subset of patients who probably responded to it would be patients who exhibited higher activity maybe or constitutional activity of the disease, cytokine release, And I think the biomarker would be something which relates to that, such as C-reactive protein. And I have been doing the C-reactive protein in my patients for the past few weeks, started doing that. And I can see a real interesting thing because I had a patient yesterday whose C-reactive protein was 132. Normal is 9. And I had another patient who was 10. And so we are going to see a spread of C-reactive protein, which really makes sense. I mean, you've treated patients with pancreatic cancer. You know, some of them have a lot of constitutional symptoms, and they have leukocytosis, for example. And it's possible that these are the patients who will be benefiting to the ruxolitinib.
I'm curious, just in those two patients, clinically, I mean, a series of two, but, you know, do you think that the one who had the high level had more suggesting cytokine or paraneoplastic?
Well, her performance status was borderline 3. She had a CA19-9 level of 138,000, and she had an albumin of 2.8. Now, I get involved with dealing with pancreas cancer in our cooperative group, and I always felt strongly about using albumin, for example, as a eligibility criterion because I think it reflects systemic effect of the disease, and I think the CRP will be probably another complement to that.
It'll be interesting to see, too. Actually, this issue comes up in myelofibrosis in terms of if there's a benefit, hopefully maybe something you can even see clinically. Is it because, you know, just relieving symptoms, better performance status, better nutrition, or does it actually affect the disease itself? I guess there are theories about how there might be an intersection between cancer pathogenesis and inflammation.
I think that's right. And also in a disease that has a lot of wasting in it, the muscle wasting, there's also some evidence that that pathway might be active in the muscle itself, and you're trying to correct that. So it could be that making the patients feel better, you can treat them better.
Although my understanding also, and even myelofibrosis, only half the patients have JAK mutations, so there's something beyond that, but that you don't see JAK mutations in pancreatic cancer. Is that true?
Correct, yes.
Interesting. So that'll be real. Hopefully we'll see something on that soon. Let's finish out talking a little bit about colon cancer. And I really like this case about the 74-year-old lady. What happened there?
Well, this patient who I saw yesterday, she already started on the capecitabine. So she was a 74-year-old lady, otherwise very healthy, enjoys life, wants to continue enjoying life. And she presented with rectal bleeding, never had colonoscopy before. This was the first time she's having it, and the sigmoid mass moderately differentiated. So she had no metastases, and therefore she underwent a sigmoid colectomy. And she had only one lymph node out of 15 and T3. And she went to see a doctor elsewhere. That was her first stop, and the oncologist talked to her about FOLFOX. And she came to me for a second opinion, and I gave her three options. I gave her four options, actually, because they always ask us what happens if we don't treat. So that was the fourth option that's out. I'm just putting it out now for the time being. So the three options were to go FOLFOX or Zolox or capecitabine. And I explained to her the pros and cons for each one. But my discussion was really more towards giving her single agent fluoropyrimidine. And if I give fluoropyrimidine single agent, there's no point in putting a port. And so capecitabine was what I was trying to explain to her, that that would be probably the best, which fits her lifestyle, fits her disease, the pathology of her disease, the stage of the disease. And also someone who really expressed to me that she wants to have good quality of life. Now, if you go back and look at the subgroup analyses of the oxaliplatin-based adjuvant trials, although you may or may not like to do that, but the reality is that in patients over 65, really we're not seeing that much of an added benefit of oxaliplatin. So in this patient, when I explained all this to her, she was happy with staying on with me and getting capecitabine. And the way I do it is that I see patients every week for the first cycle, especially in older patients, to pick up side effects early so I can manage them.
So the reason I thought about Dr. Kerr's patient is I said, well, what was the dose and schedule? And he goes, oh, yeah, 2,500 per milliliter, you know, the typical package insert. And I go, well, how did she do? And, oh, yeah, she did great. She's finished her therapy, never had any problem. Any thoughts about, I mean, it's an old story, but I just thought it was interesting. What dose and schedule did you use with her and what happened?
I used 2 g/m².
How did she do?
Well, so far she's doing, but she started recently, so she's done well.
Oh, so she just started, right.
Yeah, but I have to say that she did have some redness in her hands, so this lady, even with 2 g/m², down the line might not be the right dose for her.
Yeah, I know. When you said 2 grams per meter squared, I'm thinking, well, you might very well have problems. Anything, you know, like I said, it's an old question, but I still don't know that I have seen a great answer to why people in Europe seem to tolerate much higher doses.
Well, people have said the diet and the folic acid in the diet and then supplements, and I really don't have any better thing. I mean, with this patient, I also wanted to get an experience with, and I had sent the Oncotype DX colon test for this patient because I would like to see if I can develop my own experience in knowing patients where I don't want to give them chemotherapy even.
I was going to ask you whether you thought about Oncotype. I'm interested by the fact that you actually ordered it. You know, we saw the paper that came out from the NSABP FLOX study where they overlaid on it, you know, the Oncotype, and that included patients with node-positive tumors, and it looked like, you know, it still was an independent predictor. Did you get this lady's results back yet?
I haven't got them back, but I'm trying to build my own experience in the N1, especially when you have someone who's in her 70s and where you may want to not to give treatment even.
Any situations in a patient like this, for example, if she came back with a high Oncotype score, I mean, originally when they presented that data, they offered the thought that it might be helpful in trying to decide whether to use oxaliplatin or not. Do you see that? You know, formerly it was more a question of chemo versus not, and now, well, maybe the type of chemo. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, no, I'm aware of that, but at this point in time, if it comes higher, then I'm still not convinced of its ability for the distinction between oxaliplatin versus none, so I will stick to what I've started off with in this patient.
Any thoughts about other genomic markers? There's the coloprint for stage 2 disease.
Yeah, I don't have experience with the coloprint, but I use the Oncotype DX in patients who have stage 2 disease where clinical pathological features are not the typical high-risk patients, such as perforation, obstruction, few lymph nodes tested. Patients who have microsatellite stable disease, they have enough number of lymph nodes removed, and there is a question whether I want to give chemotherapy or not. And those patients, I have been using the Oncotype DX assay.
So let's finish out very briefly talking about your 36-year-old man who unfortunately seems like he presented with metastatic colorectal cancer.
Yeah, so this patient who works as a receptionist in a hotel in the airport in Detroit, young guy who developed back pain, initially thought because of he stands a long time, and then he had several tests and then ultimately ended up with a CAT scan which showed retroperitoneal lymph nodes. And he had a biopsy, and this showed it to be compatible with, it's an adenocarcinoma suggestive of a lower GI, so he underwent a colonoscopy, which showed an unobstructed mass in the right side of the colon, and he had KRAS wild-type and BRAF wild-type tumor. So he came to me, and he looked very fit, and he wanted everything to be done. He was with his mother, so at that point in time, I decided to give him or offer him the option of going on FOLFOXIRI plus bevacizumab, because they wanted to be as aggressive as possible. So that's what we did, and after 2 months, he had a very good partial response, and he had almost complete resolution of his back pain and a major drop in the serum CEA level. And we continued with the treatment for a while, and then he started to have more of the fatigue. And also GI symptoms became a bit more prominent after several months of treatment. So I ended up deleting the irinotecan from the combination and continuing with the FOLFOX plus bevacizumab.
And what's his current situation?
He's still in partial response, partial remission.
And what's going on with his primary?
I did not go back and look at the primary because he had the metastatic disease. It was not obstructing at the time, so we do not do operation on those patients. It's just the primary was left there.
How do the surgeons in your interdisciplinary tumor board react to the idea of, you know, leaving an asymptomatic primary in place in the face of metastatic disease as you did with this man? I'm going to guess every now and then they might go, hey, why can't we just go in there with laparoscopy and pull it out of there? You don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, with our group, because of the closeness of our relationship in terms of the multidisciplinary team, we don't have any problem. It's only when a patient has obstruction when we agree all. And there are patients who will be more gray area, which will be like they have no clinical obstruction, but the guy who did the scope says, well, it's a tight entry into the tumor area, and then so impending obstruction. And we've taken sometimes risks, but those are patients who we discuss and might be backwards and forwards. But someone who certainly has no obstructive symptoms, no nothing to suggest impending obstruction. The colonoscopy, we go ahead with chemo, and that's the discussion. That's the way it goes.
What do you do with your patients, you know, particularly those who are, well, I'm going to say, KRAS mutant, or, you know, the evolving world of testing to try to predict response to EGFR, but let's just say KRAS mutant for now. If and when they progress on FOLFOXIRI Bev, and this man you pulled back on the irinotecan, so it might make it a little bit tricky, but what's your next therapy after FOLFOXIRI Bev?
In patients who have mutant KRAS?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, we're a bit limited there. So let's say when they progress on FOLFOX and bevacizumab, if it's a progression like happens, let's say 6 months or longer since the start of the treatment, then we go for second-line treatment with FOLFIRI plus bevacizumab, so continuation of the bevacizumab. If they had a very, really brief benefit or no benefit at all, actually, then those patients, mutant KRAS, then again going to FOLFIRI plus aflibercept.
How many patients have you treated with aflibercept?
I've had a fair number of patients treated over the last 2 years. It was on the basis of patients who did not do well on the bevacizumab plus chemo combination in the front line, and then we went to second line using aflibercept plus FOLFIRI. When I say fair number, I would say maybe on average each year I've had six or so patients.
Any observations from that experience in terms of toxicity? There are people who say that it's more toxic than Bev continuation on progression. What's been your experience?
In terms of toxicity, I have sensed that there might be some more toxicity, but not the toxicity to the VEGF-VEGFR pathway. It's the toxicity with respect to the cytokines of the chemotherapy, like the GI symptoms. I've seen possibly more. But again, based on 12 to 15 patients, I can't tell you more than that.